Hello, and welcome to Don't Pee on Your Leg and Other Scientific Misconceptions, where we talk about scientific misconceptions we all have and hope that you learn something new about the world. I'm here with my co-host, Margaret, best Bibb and Tuckers, Hanslick Burton.
And joining me is my co-host, Camden, funny girl, Hanslick Burton.
Welcome to the show! Well, let's start with our first segment, something we are excited about. Margaret, why don't you go?
I am excited about fall. Since we moved back to Kansas City, I remember that summer is hot and so long. It felt longer than normal because it was so much hotter than we're used to. And so now that it's finally fall, it's almost skipped to winter. It got real cold real fast. I do not mind getting to wear sweaters, getting to go outside without thinking the mosquitoes are going to get you constantly. It's delightful. So I'm so excited about fall.
Happy fall, everybody.
Thank you. Camden?
Well, I think I shared in past episodes I had rejoined my old improv company that I had previously been on in Kansas City. I've since had my first shows live on a stage with people watching. Vaccinated people watching, the best kind of people watching. So that was really fun. It's really nice to get back in the swing and have that routine and have that outlet again.
Yeah, you're doing great.
Thanks. And also we appreciate all of you who are listening to an episode after what has been a bit of a hiatus.
A lot's happened.
My dad passed away, and that's been hard and still is hard, but he listened to the show, and so we wanted to bring the show back and give everybody something that we had heard, just like a lot of people reaching out saying they missed the show. We're back. We're hopefully back on schedule. sorry about that, but I think you all understand.
Yeah. I would say not sorry, because part of taking care of ourselves. So we appreciate you all tuning back in and giving us some time.
Yeah. And let that be a lesson to you all. You can take time for yourself too. It's fine.
It's fine.
Most of the time the world keeps spinning.
It's encouraged.
All right. Well, let's get into our favorite segment. What is that sound, Margaret? Cue that theme music. In What's That Sound, we keep with the spirit of the show, meaning one of us researches something the other doesn't know about. Where here, there's a sound that one of us doesn't know. And Margaret, you're going to play a sound.
That's correct.
I'm going to tell you what I think it is.
Okay. Are you ready?
You play it away.
Okay. Camden, what's that sound? It's a sound we find in nature?
No.
Yeah.
Humans made that sound.
And are we not part of nature, Camden?
Sure. This is taking it for a new turn. So what is that sound? Is now just clips.
No, I have a real Margaret. What's that sound.
Oh, you
tell
really
me
do?
What that sound is.
Okay, that was David S. Pumpkins.
And is a pumpkin not natural, Camden?
Okay.
Spooky season.
Margaret is too into this season. Do you have another one for us?
Yeah, but first I just want to mention, in case you also enjoy David S. Pumpkins, there is a 10-hour long loop on YouTube of the David S. Pumpkins song. It's by Rachel Clayton. It's called David Pumpkins Song, 10 Hours.
That is haunting. Okay. So, you have like negative 4 seconds to go to a real thing, because that is
disturbing. Here's a real thing. So you're going to ignore, I will tell you this, you're going to ignore the bird sound.
Yeah, I figured.
Okay.
I'm going to say a glacier breaking away. Ooh. It definitely doesn't sound like an animal. I mean, it might be an animal.
There was a bird.
Yeah, no, I just meant like, I didn't think it was like a low grumble of like a big animal. I think it was something Abiotic. Mm-hmm. Something not living making that sound. Can I hear it again?
Yes.
Now it sounds less like glacial. Well, it might still be like, because I also feel like I heard something that sounded watery.
Okay.
Or like a ocean wave crashing, and it just never stopped crashing.
Hmm.
Is that a?
You're moving farther away.
Ah, oops! It's a glacier breaking.
It is. The sound of an avalanche.
Oh.
That is what an avalanche sounds like. The YouTube channel Bifon Records recorded this sound in Norway in 2008. So that is the sound of an avalanche in 2008.
Wow. That sounded, I assume for safety reasons they were like far away.
They were. Yes, okay. They were far away.
That makes sense.
I would not want to hear that sound up close if I were the recipient of that avalanche. No. So I just thought it was really interesting because I've heard in different, different people who have witnessed avalanches says it sounds kind of like a train. To me, it kind of sounds like an airplane taking off.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard tornadoes sound like trains,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that, yeah, that didn't sound, I mean, maybe closer up it would have, but yeah, it didn't sound like that.
I will mention something. I was going to play a sound of a tornado, but I couldn't find a clean sound of a tornado with no cursing on top of it. So,
I mean, that's fair.
Which is fair.
In that moment, I don't want someone recording me either.
No. So that is the sound of an avalanche in Norway. Nice job, Camden.
Thanks, Margaret. All right, let's head into the main segment of the show, the misconceptions. Every episode, we bring a new misconception to share, explain, and discuss. As a note, each co-host researches their misconception on their own, brings it to the podcast, and the other co-host has never heard of it. This is just to make it feel more like a discussion where the other person doesn't have to feel like they need to prepare or, do anything heavy lifting in front, and they just get to learn alongside you all,
mm-hmm,
the audience. And Margaret, let's go back to our old
wheel of names.com by
proud unofficial sponsor of the show.
Yes, by just a hair's breadth, I have won.
Wow,
just on the line. You can see it here. Yes, I have won. I promise I did not rig it, but I'm very excited.
Let's do it.
So I was, I got a new job where I teach students about social emotional learning and respecting animals and people. And recently I was teaching a class and one of the students, I said, okay, we have time for questions. Does anyone have any questions? And the student said, why do cats always land on their feet? And
yeah, why
thought,
do they?
Huh. That is a really good misconception. So that is why we're here discussing this today. Do cats always land on their feet? And if so, why? So my sources are an interview with Dr. Kat Arney, no pun intended.
Okay, hold on. Maria, you can't just make up names and then write whatever you want.
No, the cat had a little stethoscope.
Miss Professor Flips McGrath.
Dr. Meowford?
Yeah, the third. Go ahead.
Dr. Kat Arney on The Naked Scientists, Live Science, National Geographic, and BBC News. So we can agree that cats have very good balance. We've all seen a cat jump from the counter to a refrigerator and back down to the floor with astonishing ease and grace. Why do you think they are so... What in the evolutionary past would make a domestic cat so good at those feats, Camden, do you think?
Their evolutionary past, you mean like big...
Their ancestors.
Like, uh-huh. Like big ancient cats?
Not even ancient. Yeah, big cats.
Well, I just meant ancient as like...
Oh, sure.
Like the ancestor that the common domestic cat might have shared with like a lion or...
Yes.
something further back.
That's correct. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Yes. I did not phrase that in a helpful way, but you are correct. So cats are related to big cats, came from big cats, who a lot of them spend their time in trees and need really good balance to navigate their surroundings. So if you think of, I mean, even lions have fairly good balance in trees, but pumas, those kinds of cats spend a lot of time in trees and they have good balance. So cats, domestic cats, have this reflex that I learned about called the air writing reflex. The air writing reflex. Oh, so they're writing themselves in the air.
Not writing, like ride the air, dude.
Mm-hmm. No, they are writing it, not left, but right. And they develop this very early on. I think it starts to develop around 4 weeks of age for a kitten. And by seven weeks, they've perfected it. They know exactly how to do it. And it has a lot to do with a cat's inner ears. So it's not just cats that have this writing reflex, though. Rabbits have it, rats have it, and some other animals have it, too.
I've heard that buttered bread has it.
That's a different misconception.
Do you like that?
Yes.
Okay.
That's very that's all I very needed. Good. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. So the cat's inner ear tells them that they are not the... Are you still laughing about your buttered bread?
I'm not laughing. I'm smiling. There's no crime against smiling. Don't look over here.
Okay.
Look at your notes.
Okay. Cat's inner ears tell them whether they're upside down or right side up. And when a cat realizes that they're falling and are upside down, they will try to flip over, of course, so they land feet first. And first, so the steps are as follows. A cat bends in half when they are starting to fall. Not bends in half, but kind of twists in half.
Okay.
And the
twists front, half of its body.
Yes. And the front half of their body turns in the opposite direction of the back half. So think about if like you're wringing out a towel.
Owie.
Not exactly, but you know what I mean. You're turning in two different directions. Then the cat tucks in their front legs so that they can turn the front half of their bodies farther. Then the cat stretches their back legs out so their back half doesn't turn as much.
I'm trying to do this.
I know. And so now the cat's front half is right side up with paws facing down. And then the cat tucks in their back legs and stretches out their front legs so the back paws are facing the floor. So then they're right side up and they land on their feet. If this is not making sense, I completely understand. You can see National Geographic has a cool slow motion video on YouTube of how a cat does this, and you can see those steps one by one. But suffice it to say, it is interesting and very cool to me.
Have we dropped humans into like foam pits to see if they'll do it too?
I don't think we don't do it. We don't do it. We can't do it. And there are other reasons that wouldn't matter anyway. But you can see this happen in slow motion. It'll make sense. And all cats follow the same steps. That's they always do.
Because it's in their education.
It's in their core competency tests. So the constraints, which
they're
you were mentioning,
in cats. I'm done.
The constraints are, we believe cats generally have safer landings if they fall at least 2 feet or half a meter from the ground because they need time.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
To adjust themselves.
Yeah, you can't do that if you drop them real close.
Yeah, and also, let's just say this. Please don't drop a cat to test this out.
Yeah, don't go home and do an
experiment.
Please
don't drop a cat. But they do need time and a certain height to right themselves. And I was learning that the injuries that a cat sustains from a fall have to do with how high the cat falls from and what it lands on. So
that was what I was wondering. Like, I assume there's like a too high.
Yes. Well, we'll get into that. So even if a cat falls from a certain height, lands on their feet, if they're landing on concrete, that is still going to mean some pretty serious injuries. Yeah. It still is not going to be a painless situation for the cat. they tend to have broken bones from landing on hard surfaces when they fall from over 30 feet or 10 meters.
Okay.
But they do have a lot going for them in terms of adaptations that allow them to right themselves and suffer less damage. So one of the reasons...
Well, they can ride the air.
They can ride the air. Their spines, I learned that cats have extra vertebrae more than we do.
Okay.
So that allows them to twist their backs around in the air. They also have angled legs.
Angled
so our
legs.
Our legs are straight up and down vertical, about 90 degrees from the ground. But cats are angled. So that's what I was saying before. If we could
different
always,
than like a dog?
I think a dog too, but a dog doesn't have that ability to turn themselves around. But you were saying earlier, could we always ride ourselves? For us, it wouldn't matter because...
Oh, yeah.
Because all of that force would be sent straight up to our legs, which would probably break.
That's bad.
But cats, because they're angled, their bones are not absorbing all of that directly.
Oh, that makes sense. That's like they tell you if an elevator's falling, you're actually supposed to lay down.
Yeah, spread out. Spread out.
The force out.
Yeah. And cats also have a large surface area in proportion to how much they weigh, which reduces how hard they're hitting the ground. And they reach a terminal velocity at, it's not going to sound slow, but pretty slow speeds compared to larger animals like us. So as a reminder, terminal velocity is the speed at which the downward force of gravity equals the upward force of wind resistance. And so an average cat, and I don't know how they figured this out.
Oh. NSF. What were you doing on this one?
What are you doing? An average cat reaches terminal velocity at about 60 miles an hour.
They might have done it in a wind tunnel, but even then it's...
Or maybe just a sort of a, you know, calculation.
Some guy sitting with a chair.
Yeah. Well, and then they figured out that an average man reaches terminal velocity at about double that. So about 120 miles an hour.
Oof.
So 60 miles an hour is still... fast,
I
but
would
not
rather
as fast
fall
as
at
us.
That than the right. other one.
Right. So they have some things that are helping them out. So then we want to introduce this thing, this phenomenon called high-rise syndrome. And that is when cats hurt themselves when they fall from more than 30 feet. Or when cats, basically, the idea of high-rise syndrome is that there is a height at which if they fall from high enough, they won't hurt themselves. So then we bring in this thing, this phenomenon called high-rise syndrome, which is the idea that perhaps falling from greater heights means less injuries. So there was a study in the 1980s that looked at vet records of cats that were brought to vets after falling from different heights. And the study suggests that 90% of cats that fell from buildings lived, and that their survival rate increased if they fell from more than six stories.
Because, like, maybe they had more time to adjust.
They may have had more time to adjust. I wouldn't think about this. The study is a bit called into question sometimes because of the element of cats that didn't survive their fall were not counted.
Oh, yeah. They weren't brought in.
Because you wouldn't bring that cat into a vet.
Please help my cat.
So that fact would skew the study's findings. They're not including... They're finding that 90% of cats that fell from buildings lived, but they're not seeing the cats that,
so it might
that
not.
Passed away on impact.
Well, also, like, to what you're saying, like, to what use is this information, really? Short of, like, you've already... I think shared a good part about how cats right themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The actual, like, to what point do we need to know the height? Because what are you doing with that cat? Like, why do you care so much about what height it needs to be at?
Right, right. So more recent studies have found that the further a cat falls, the more likely they are to have serious or fatal injuries, as you would suspect.
Yeah.
Especially if you put concrete into the equation, which we mentioned earlier. So the bottom line is, please, if you're in a high rise, keep a screen on your window and don't let your cat get near to a situation where they would accidentally fall out. Because there's just no guarantee. It's not a great time for them anyway. You don't want to bet on the fact that they're going to land on their feet, because they usually do, but they don't always. And even if cats do land on their feet, it doesn't mean they're not injured.
So the misconception, do cats always land on their feet? Depends on the height.
Depends on the height. And I would say usually, but it doesn't always turn out well.
Yeah.
And that's nice. I did not tell that child that answer. Yeah. I said, I think they usually do. And then
that seems like the right answer. Yeah, there.
He was six. We didn't get into air riding and the physics of reflexes. So
ride that air, kid. You high five.
All right, Camden, your turn.
Thanks, Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Margaret.
Oh, this feels familiar. Go ahead.
When you eat a veggie dog or some mac and cheese.
Yes.
Or a kale salad.
Yes.
Or vegan chicken and dumplings.
We just had that. Cameron just made that. It was very good.
Where does that food get digested?
Inside of my body. My torso. Mm-hmm. I would say around the belly button.
What is digesting your food?
My tummy.
Say
my stomach.
Okay. Jeez. But Margaret, is the stomach?
I bet not.
The only place you digest food?
No, Camden, you silly.
Yeah, why did you say your tummy?
Silly, I don't know.
Tummy and the stomach.
Speaking of tummy and things, I think muggins. I learned this too. Muggins is a British word for cat.
All right.
I just wanted to get that in there.
Glad you.
So I thought it was in the stomach that we digest everything. Because that's where all the acid lives.
Let's find out. So my citations are the Heritage Victor Valley Medical Group, the textbook Biology for a Changing World, first edition, and the Canadian Society of Intestinal Research, also known as SEER.
Wow.
I don't know if they say that.
Okay.
So let's first off, what is digestion, Margaret?
It is when the nutrients of the food that you consume are separated from the things that are not useful, and they each go on a different path through your body.
Yeah. So the breakdown of food into subunits or the nutrients that we want. So we absorb nutrients, and that breakdown of food, and I'm going to clarify this because it matters for most of this misconception, can be both mechanical and chemical. Okay.
Mechanical and chemical. Okay.
So digestion is not just one or the other. It is both mechanical and chemical.
Can you explain what you mean? Are you going to explain what you mean by both of those terms?
Yes. Okay. I'll start with one part of this, and then we'll get it. Basically, mechanical is like physical breaking down of something.
Right.
And chemical is using some chemical, some kind of enzyme. Molecule, like an enzyme that we'll talk about, to also break it down.
Okay.
Right. So like you could pour like a chemical acid on something and make it dissolve, or you could smash it and make it smaller.
And that would be.
But our body does both.
Mechanical. Okay.
Yes.
Great.
So Margaret, you kind of already got at this. Why do we digest food? Why would we even digest it?
To get nutrients and energy.
Very good. So the nutrients are to build us up, like literally to build the things inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
And also we can get energy that those food molecules have in them, or the molecules inside the food. I'm not going to get too deep into like the energy part. I'm just going to use like a general word for energy. That'll be a misconception another day about what we call energy in food.
Okay. I look forward to it.
And you mentioned this, once we get everything we need out of that food, what happens?
We excrete it.
The rest of it is excreted as waste. Yes. All right, Margaret. So give me a very general, in what body system does digestion happen?
In your stomach and your intestines.
What's that whole system called?
Digestive
system. The digestive system. I'm stone cold sober. I just can't speak.
It is 9:45.
So the digestive system is mostly a tract, like a tube, that pushes food from the mouth to the anus.
Wow.
In its most simplest form, that is what our digestive system does.
I think it's an elegant simplicity.
It is. And we have lots of muscles in our digestive system that help push it through our body. And you know this because if you've ever laid down, you didn't just stop being able to move food through you.
That is very true. Just, thank goodness.
And I say that because sometimes little kids are like, oh, it just kind of falls through you slowly. Like, well, ish.
With help.
With help. Yes, child, with help. And there are other organs, as you sort of alluded to, that are part of the digestive system, the stomach being one of them. Even some of them are not, though, on the main tract, the main stretch of the tube.
Highway, the main highway.
And so let's get into the digestive system and really think about where does all this digestion happen? Margaret, what is the start of the digestive system?
Mouth.
Mouth. Margaret, what mechanically digests, what parts of you help? Why are you answering so fast? You're scared.
I like to show you that I know answers.
Okay.
Gotta be the fastest.
Mechanical digestion. Wow, I picked the worst. I think I was nailing it earlier. I think it got in my head. The mechanical digestion starts with the teeth and your tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Chemically, what chemicals are being used in
saliva?
Saliva.
Chemicals in saliva?
There's a lot of enzymes in saliva that mostly break down the carbohydrates in our food.
Okay.
And so I mentioned carbohydrates because there are other things in our along the way that will help digest the other parts. I never thought of the tongue like this, but the tongue is really helpful in compressing the food into a small ball that kind of rolls down the esophagus.
Good Lord.
Which I had never really thought of it that way, and I thought that was kind of fun.
That's so fun. You're right.
And I already broke, I told you what's next. The esophagus.
Mm-hmm.
And so the esophagus is where we talk about muscles involved.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what goes on with muscles and the esophagus?
Swallowing.
So you swallow, and then there's a rhythmic contraction and relaxation of muscles that push the food down your throat, your esophagus. That is called peristalsis, if you just want to sound.
Oh, I've heard of that.
And I say that because I feel like everyone at some point was told the word peristalsis for some reason. And
but
that
I don't remember
what
it was.
Okay.
It's the rhythmic... Say it again.
Contracting and relaxing of muscles. So think of it like you need toothpaste out of a tube.
Uh-huh.
You push at the bottom and you push a little higher up and you push a little higher up and you push a little higher up, push a little higher up and it keeps moving up.
Uh-huh.
That's peristalsis.
And you've got a big old pile of toothpaste on your counter.
Yeah, except this one, it's food. And this one is still mechanically breaking down the food. So they're pushing that food down.
Okay.
It's still mechanically breaking down a bit. After that, we get to... your old friend, the tummy, the stomach. So you had mentioned earlier, what happens in the stomach?
There are acids that break down food chemically.
So, yeah, there are acids and enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the acids, well, there's different reasons. What do the enzymes do?
They...
Well, you sort of said it, I guess.
They break down the food. Food?
Yeah.
They help to break it down?
So they help break down the food.
Isn't that what the stomach acid does too, though?
Well, so the enzymes live in the acid.
Okay.
There's a very important reason, and this is great. It's sort of, I always love sort of misconceptions within each other. I think a lot of people will sort of say like, the acid is the enzyme, the enzyme's the acid. They're all the same.
I thought that.
The enzymes live in the acid. It's like their little lake, so to speak.
Oof.
Why is it so acidic, though? Because it's not real, while it does... break the food down, that's not really its primary goal there.
Is that when the pulling out of the nutrients process starts? Or the getting rid of stuff we don't want starts?
We aren't getting rid of something we don't want. It's not that we're getting rid of food.
It's that we're getting rid...
Why do we cook food sometimes?
Hotter.
Yeah. Why would you cook steak?
I don't know.
Why would you cook meat before eating it raw?
To kill the bacteria on
it? Yes.
To make sure you don't get...
acids.
Salmonella?
Acids kill a lot of the bacteria that's still in our food.
That is why I think they sometimes squirt lemon juice on fish to make it.
It could be. But it is really cool. Like, our bodies have evolved to handle a lot of bacteria and have like a safety mechanism in case you do. Because everyone's had that experience with like, I think I drank expired milk, or I think I ate something that had mold on it and I only discovered it halfway. Your body does have systems, and obviously sometimes that can break through, but does have systems to try to kill a lot of that. So the acid is really there to kill the bad bacteria. There's also mechanical like churning inside your stomach that sort of helps break down. So it's not just chemical. And mostly the enzymes in your stomach are breaking down proteins.
Okay.
And
they're breaking them down.
Yeah. And I just say that because I think sometimes there's this idea of digestion is digestion. Everything's being broken down a bit by bit by bit by bit.
Mm-hmm.
But like there's different parts of your digestive system that are helpful in breaking down certain parts of your food. So like if you're eating candy, a lot of the carbohydrates are being in the sugars are being digested right in the beginning. Whereas like if you had like spinach, something more protein dense,
mm-hmm.
a lot of that's going to get digested in your stomach. Because that's
so every part has a different job.
Yes.
Or different.
They're focus. Not all like secreting like one enzyme that just breaks it down more.
Okay.
Which I just kind of thought was interesting.
Yeah.
What happens after the stomach?
That is when the intestines come. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember which intestine comes first? Ugh. They don't come out. They just, the food gets to it.
Is it the large intestine first?
And we get to the small one first. dang. And Margaret, guess what? Dun, 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 dun. What? This is the major organ involved in digestion.
The small intestine?
So while the misconception really is that the stomach is not where digestion happens, it happens all along.
Mm-hmm. The path.
If you were to argue, and I'm sure someone could be more pedantic about it, I would say the small intestines are where most of the digestion that we think of happens. This is where the pancreas, the liver, and the gallbladder all are secreting like this amazing flurry of enzymes that help break down our food. And this is where all of the nutrients that we think that we're getting out of food are being absorbed.
Extracted. Oh.
So it's not just extracted, but this is the absorption phase. Okay. The small intestines are key number one to absorption. So when we think about we're going to get something out of the food, that's where it's happening.
Is that why our intestines are so long, so that our food has the best chance it can of having its nutrients absorbed?
Look at
Kevin's pointing his finger at me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Because, yeah, we want it to have a lot of time to be absorbed. So if you look at little fingies, your little digits,
yeah.
If you were to put your hand sort of palm up and sort of wiggle your fingers looking at them, that is kind of what the inside of your intestines look like.
Oh, I don't.
It's not a smooth tube.
I don't like that.
It's
like an anemone?
It's almost like you have this lined jellyfish all inside you. Margaret, why are those that
more
way?
More surface area.
Look
why
at
is it
you.
So wiggly?
It's mostly I like to make them wiggle.
Like a coral.
But you think of it like a stream of food kind of passing over them and they're sort of
gorgeous.
And those are directly connected to the bloodstream, which is going to take take those nutrients away
and disperse them
across the body.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why this is where you will see like a blood sugar spike after eating, for example.
Okay.
It's happening in the small intestines. So just when, you know, when people think of like, oh, I just ate something, I might get like a blood sugar spike. It's happening in the small intestines because that's where all the stuff is being absorbed.
So then what does the large intestine do if the small intestine is doing the heavy lifting?
So it's doing the heavy lifting. At the end, large intestines are just to make sure we're getting any water that's left over. So there's a lot of water absorption there. And that's where food is finally being compacted into fecal matter.
Okay.
And it's also where a lot of the good bacteria in our body live. They feed on a lot of the other parts of our food. They will release vitamins for them and us. And when people talk about a healthy gut, that large intestine is really helpful in that too.
Okay.
And fiber is being released to compact your food.
So it's doing a lot as well.
So it's doing a lot.
Okay.
But as far as the absorbing, that's really the small intestines, and a lot of the other enzymes come into play in the small intestines. So that's your digestive system.
Wow.
Your stomach is not the only place to digest food.
In this digestion game.
Yep. And if you're thinking about where you actually get something out of it, the small intestines are where the action happens, Captain. And I'll leave you with this. Margaret, do all organisms digest food?
No. Yes. Yes.
Most of them do. Bacteria use enzymes. Fungus use enzymes, although they will digest things outside of their body,
mm-hmm.
And then absorb them. Animals, like I said before, really have evolved from just one opening where a digestive, what they call like a cavity, like a little bag of digestion happens.
Gorgeous. Uh-huh.
And that bag became a tube.
Mm-hmm.
And so like jellyfish are a bag.
Mm-hmm.
And a tube, you could think of like a little nematode, just like a opening, like a mouth tube, but,
mm-hmm.
And then as life evolved, it got more
complex,
but it, at its most basic, mouth tube, butt, or if you're a jellyfish, done. Mouth tube, butt, all one thing, gets the job done. You're right. So there you go, friends.
Thank you. Wow, Camden. It really is. I remember sometimes I listened to a particular episode of Sawbones where I think Justin McElroy was saying, our bodies really do a lot and it all works together. And sometimes I worry that something will go wrong and then the whole system will fall apart. And then how is it all working together? And asked his wife, Sydney, who's a doctor, if she ever thought about that and about how like everything has to go so right for us to just be a person. And she said, yeah, sometimes I start thinking about it and then I go make dinner and I don't think about it anymore. So that is something I will do when I think more about how our digestive system works.
Yeah. Or just saying like how amazing
it is. It amazing. Oh, absolutely.
That like you eat an apple and you're like, psh, I ate an apple. I'm still going to be hungry. But like your body is working so hard to get everything it can on this little apple.
Right now, my body is working hard to get everything it can out of our
vegan chicken
and dumplings. Yes.
All right, Margaret, before we end every episode, we want to share something we've been reading, listening to, watching, or consuming. Margaret, what have you been consuming?
Oh, I get to go first again? Okay. No takesies, backsies. I and Camden have been watching a show and finished it called Midnight Mass. It's on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And it came out a couple weeks ago. It's by the same director and a lot of the same cast as Haunting of Hill House and Haunting of Bly Manor, with Kate Siegel, who is in all of those, and then also a couple other movies. But it's very, very good. It's about, without giving anything away, it's about this priest who comes into this town, and it's kind of a sleepy little depressing sort of island.
Spooky things
start to happen. And if you like Friday Night Lights, you might see a familiar face with Matt Saracen. It's very good. It is very spooky, very well done. And I think it was perfect for an October evening.
Nice, Margaret.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well,
that means a lot.
I'm glad. I've been listening to the audiobook of Never Split the Difference on the advice of a colleague. It's by Chris Voss, who was a FBI investigator, FBI investigator. And at first I was sort of like, I don't need this. Cause it was all about like the science behind negotiating. And I thought like, I don't negotiate my job, but mm-hmm. he does a really good job of like, we are always negotiating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you need to go to bed early to a child, I assume you say, to like negotiating, like just there's lots of negotiation, like people trying to get something out of someone or get someone to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Like negotiations happen all the time,
mm-hmm.
Especially in our jobs of like, even if we're not selling something, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
In like his case, he wasn't ever selling anything. He was negotiating that people would protect like hostages or come out without hurting themselves, mm-hmm. or So like, obviously those stakes were very high. I just thought he kind of breaks it down into just like ways that I really appreciate in. I won't go into all of it, but some things I took from it that were really helpful were like, people are always afraid of someone saying no to them.
Mm-hmm.
But like sort of the art of a negotiation is like people, when someone says no, you get information like, okay, they don't want this thing I'm talking about. Now I have information. Let's talk about something that you might like.
Okay.
And then another thing I really appreciate was naming people's like fears. And so often like people don't like, if you're selling something or, you know, trying to negotiate something, like you really want someone to do you a favor, like watch your dog for a long weekend, but you don't want them to, like, that's giving up their whole weekend.
Yeah.
He said there's like a lot of research behind just say like, we really want you to watch our dog over the weekend. I know it means you have to give up your whole weekend. I know it means like you might have to cancel plans or you won't get to do stuff and like go out. But we really like, we'll really appreciate it. And so like people like it when you don't actually skirt the pain that something might be
providing.
When you
are head on about just like, head on, like, I know this is inconvenient.
Because people really just like to hear their fears like recognized or their concerns and not like a fear, but... so yeah,
what Kim is trying to say is we're trying to learn different tactics for getting people to babysit Satchel Paige, our dog.
Clearly these are the things I feel like we have to negotiate. So if you're listening and you want to watch a dog, there's actually nothing to negotiate. She's great.
She's so great. She's going to be 1 year old.
Oh, you'll be listening to this on her birthday. Scream happy birthday wherever you are right now.
Go for it. We're waiting. Hold on. Cameron, wait, hold on.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was really nice of you. I appreciate you doing that.
You didn't have to sing it, but that was really nice. Thank you so much.
You can wipe away the tears. That's a lot. Yeah.
And the spit.
Yeah. So with that, thank you so much for listening today. If you like this episode or any of our others, please give us a quick review. Written reviews help new listeners find us. And, you know, we just appreciate it. We've been out for a while. We are glad you are back. Give us a review if you've never done so before.
And even if you have. We also...
I don't know if they can give us a review again.
Just try it out.
Okay.
It's a free country. We also have a bookshop site. You can find all of the books we've ever recommended on our podcast in one place, at Bookshop. So Bookshop helps readers find books at independent bookstores while giving a percentage of any books you buy to us, the folks that recommended them. So you can support us and small businesses by checking out our Bookshop page at bookshop.org/shop/don't-pee-on-your-leg.
And you can find more content from us on our social media pages, which are about to be live again. We'll shake the dust off at Instagram at Don't Pee on Your Leg.
Twitter at Don't Pee on Your Leg, just the letter P.
And Facebook at facebook.com/don't-pee-on-your-leg.
Don't Pee on Your Leg and Other Scientific Misconceptions is a podcast produced by Two Birds, One Scone. Articles, blog posts, and more about what you can do every day to conserve our environment can be found at twobirdsonescone.org.
Our original theme music is by Camillo.
And if you have any scientific misconceptions that you'd like explained or you want to provide feedback to us, please email us at don'tpeeonyourleg@gmail.com.
Have a great week.